Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Dave Cowan. He's an author, spiritual coach and teacher, and we're going to discuss his new book, Navigating the Collapse of Time, which I understand is due out into the bookstores in this coming month. Welcome to the program, Dave.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me on.
Well, you're very welcome. I have to say, not too long ago, I had a guest on my program, similar to your situation, where I reviewed one of his books and we spoke about it. And I did say at the time that I could have written his book myself. It was very much in my way of thinking and style. But with your book, I find it even more so. So I think we're very much on a similar vibration when it comes to these subjects. So I really enjoyed reading your book.
Well, thank you. I find that really interesting. And just to let you know, the book actually is out now. I've been checking on Amazon, and they must have released it earlier. June 1st was the release date, but I see it's actually available now. And we wandered into Barnes & Noble the other day and saw copies in there as well.
All right, so this is a very opportune time for people to hear about the contents of your book. Now, is it correct to summarize it in general terms as being something to help people towards ascension?
Yes, I would say so, although for many folks that still is kind of an esoteric subject, although I understand in your home country maybe not as much as here. But definitely, at very least, to be able to have a wider scope on the changes, on the monumental changes that are occurring and that are coming into our awareness now every day, and to be able to see a larger context. And, you know, between you and I and those who are comfortable with spiritual concepts, definitely this is about preparing not only for personal ascension, but to be proactive and participate in this planetary ascension.
Right. I've made a few notes, obviously, having read your book, just to highlight perhaps some points that you might like to speak about. Mm-hmm. And in the first chapter, you're talking about Christianity, and I think you refer to it, to use your words, having some mouldy old doctrines. What do you think of the chances of people who have, say, rather strong religious views in being able to reach ascension?
Well, I think religions as an institution, I kind of see them as containers. You know, they contain individuals who are, you know, entering into that mindset, you might say, on some kind of a soul agreement, some kind of an ultimate purpose. And so it is entirely possible to awaken within a religious context. I guess the trick is in recognizing that a religious context is not a guarantee for awakening. So in some ways, it can actually present a greater challenge, particularly if we are strongly attached mentally or emotionally to a specific set of doctrines or ideas. When we talk about religion, we're really talking about a dualistic mindset, for the most part, and particularly Western religions, where it's very easy to become polarized into feeling that what I believe or what my church believes is right, and in contrast to belief systems that are wrong. And I suppose the trap in that is we become polarized, we become solidified in an opinion, we take a position, and it makes it very difficult to awaken to states of oneness and equality when you're feeling either better than or worse than another group.
Indeed, yes, I agree with you there. Now, you also talk early in the book about your own experience, which you describe as the Holy Spirit filling you, and that helped your spiritual awakening. I think our listeners might like to know a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I use the term Holy Spirit for a couple of reasons. In the experience, which happened a few decades ago now, actually in my late teens, early 20s, around 1972. The experience was the result of an actual prayer to receive the Holy Spirit. Not that I had any concept of what that was or meant, other than that the person leading me in that experience was using that terminology. And as it turned out, it was a very transformative prayer. It actually put me into an altered state for a few weeks where I was definitely switched channels, you might say. I was perceiving every experience that was coming into my awareness on multiple levels simultaneously. And it was, as I say in the book, equally fascinating and frightening. My understanding of what the Holy Spirit is, and again, it's a term that is couched, obviously, in religious terminology. And for myself, even, I had to go beyond that description or understanding, that it is simply the active aspect of the divine. It's the divine in action, you might say. And so you could equally call the Holy Spirit the inner healer, the voice of God. You could call it love, for that matter. It's the active, I almost see it as a spiral intentional will that moves through creation. And so Holy Spirit now works for me because I see it actually spelled with a W, holy, that is whole and complete, and spirit, yes, in that it's coming from a place of totality.
Yes, that's rather nice. It certainly changed your life, I guess, the way you would see it, for the better. Now, you talk of cosmological alignments, referring to the galaxy center, black holes, proton bands, solar cycles, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Where do you see that as coming into the story on a level of importance?
Well, I'm seeing the cosmos now, and the universe for that matter, not so much as a cause of anything, but as an effect. And as an effect, it's an effect of our collective mind, or what some call consciousness. And so it's really a feedback system. Whatever we can observe out there is really a projection or an image, you might say, reflecting back to us our state of awareness. So when it's kind of like synchronicities. You know, they're all around us, but we're not necessarily aware of them. But when we tune into a synchronicity, there's a sense that we're seeing a pattern from a higher perspective. And there's a bit of a comfort in that. So when we look at these alignments, which are based in the physical realm, at least, on predictable cycles, we can see a reflection back to us of this awareness of higher orders of stability and purpose, not only in the universe out there, but in the mind in here. So our ability to even perceive that something like, you know, our solar system is aligning with the galactic center, I think is indicative of a vast expansion in human awareness as we expand beyond our bodies, our continents, our planet, out into the galaxy, and ultimately into the universe at large, as, again, a reflection back to us of our progress, our state of awareness. So these alignments, I think, as I mentioned in the book somewhere, talk about really our ability to perceive a plan beyond our, you know, circumscribed lives. Those little blips in time we call our lives are really very small reference points. But when we can look outside and see, for example, a cycle of 26,000 years being reflected back to us in our environment, we've obviously expanded beyond the, the limits of a single lifetime. And so the alignment that we're talking about, which is recognized by many different disciplines and seers and traditions now, is to me symbolic of the reconciliation or the rejoining between the masculine essence symbolized by the sun and the feminine symbolized by the galactic center. And if you extrapolate that onto the problems in this world and the problems historically with the divisions between us, you know, one way of seeing these conflicts that we've been enduring now for eons upon eons is an imbalance in the male and the female essence, or between yin and yang energies, if you prefer. And this is another aspect of separation or duality, which is the state of separation here in the third dimension. So these alignments, to me, reflect back to me the hope, the promise that these opposite energies are going to get back together again and recognize each other in love and harmony rather than in opposition and separation. And this, to me, symbolizes the beginning of a new age, of an age of international cooperation between ways, views of the world, whether they be political or religious or economic. So it's a very hopeful sign. To me, it's a reflection of a shift and a coming together of these seemingly disparate energies between the male and the female essence.
Yes, indeed. Again, I agree with you. What we're really looking at is reaching a state of balance between the two, because they have been rather lopsided in the past. I love your title of one of your chapters, Dimensional Dancing. I can't imagine what sort of image that brings to people's mind, but it sounds very ideal, because you talk of dimensions and energy vibrations. But what I wanted to ask you from that particular chapter is, you refer, to my mind, quite correctly, that duality is an illusion. But how would you explain that to someone who can only see around them everything that's physical and just cannot grasp that idea?
Well, I guess the first step in stepping beyond the perception of duality is to accept or perhaps recognize the limits of perception itself. You know, human knowledge, of course, has grown by leaps and bounds in the last few centuries. And, you know, now we now have, particularly with the Internet, we have limitless amounts of information coming our way, and yet it doesn't seem to really add up to all that much, you know, as far as the world scale of peace and harmony and the solving of world problems. All of our information and our knowledge seems to actually lead to the need for more information and knowledge. So I guess it's it might even be a developmental stage when a person realizes that the grand sum of the knowledge that I have accumulated so far in my life has really added up to not much, if nothing at all. In other words, we need to get to that point of exhaustion almost, where our thoughts, our ideas, our philosophies, our beliefs have still not brought us to that place of peace and understanding, and that we look at the whole notion of perception, perhaps with a bit of a doubtful eye, that we will ever figure things out on the level of thought and perception. I call this the beginning of wisdom, when we come to the end of our own understanding and realize that we hold nothing in our hands. And then we begin to, by necessity, look beyond our own thinking, beyond our own perceptions. And that actually brings us to the level of feeling. So what I've been describing now goes back to our discussion of the male and the female, because this tendency to want to, you know, battle through our challenges through thinking about our problems and problem solving is a very yang male orientation, whereas the release into not knowing, the release into accepting our limitations, is really more of a yin energy or expression. So it does relate to what we talked about before. When we can begin to creatively doubt our own thoughts and beliefs, we open ourselves to something totally new, something I call inspiration. And it doesn't come from outside of us. It actually comes from within us, as does the entire universe, as I was indicating earlier. So something new, you know, there's a saying in biology that nature abhors a vacuum. But until we actually create a vacuum in our awareness, that is, being aware that we of what we don't know, nature or inspiration can't flow. So when we kind of intellectually, you might say, hit bottom, that's when something new emerges. You know, Einstein and the Maharishi both came to the same conclusion years ago. They both said in their own way that you cannot solve a problem on the level of the mind that caused or created the problem. Mm. So much of our mental wrestling with problems is really working on the level of the mind that created the problem, one that perceives differences and separation rather than coming from a perspective of wholeness. So I'm not quite sure if I answered your question, but for me, the understanding that I really don't know anything at all was the beginning of my appreciation of a divine plan beyond my own, you know, individual perception.
Hmm. Well, you have probably gone beyond the point I questioned you on there, but it was basically wondering how someone who couldn't understand why their life and everything around them would be called an illusion when it seems such a firm and obvious reality. I mean, how do you get to understand that it is an illusion?
I understand your question, and I guess for me is I've realized quite some time ago that you can't make anyone understand anything that they're not ready to accept. So I suppose if I came down to an actual verbal discussion of the nature of reality and illusion, I would have to mention that what we have been comfortable with as far as our definition of reality in the 20th century has really been limited, again, to our senses, what we can measure, what we can see, what we can taste, what we can feel. And we consider this, you know, a very stable version of reality, and yet our own physics tells us that our senses are not giving us a picture of reality. They're slicing reality into infinitesimal small bits, which in and of themselves have very little meaning, only the meaning we give them. For example, our visual sense, which empirical science relies on very heavily to prove hypotheses, is only showing us 1% of the electromagnetic spectrum. So I guess my beginning to explain to someone the nature of illusion and reality would be to help them appreciate and agree that our senses are not really telling us the whole thing. They're not giving us the whole picture. That there's much more happening beyond our ability to measure or sense. And thus, reliance on intellect and personal experience in the world is not that reliable.
Right. So would you say, in addition to that, that our real self is a spiritual being, and not a physical being, which some people believe that is all they are?
Yes, indeed. And I suppose, you know, I've come to, especially in the energy that we're in now, I have to say that the energy we are in now is totally unique to any other time in history, so we don't have a reference point as to what's going on this planet. I'm referring to the fact that we have entered the final and ninth stage of the Mayan nine-step pyramid model of time. And in this final stage, which is very close, well, it is the top of the pyramid, just as a pyramid shape-wise is concentrated at the apex, so our experience of time is being compressed into a very small space right now. We entered an acceleration of time as an experience by a factor of 20 on March 9th, just passed. So when that happened, I made an inner decision that I'm no longer going to struggle to convince people against their will that they are spiritual beings, because it's almost at the point now where we have made our decisions and we're going to all live with the consequences of that choices. The best service I can offer in this world is to be an example of someone on an awakening path, and that example itself will speak more than any convincing arguments at this time. Mm.
Yes, indeed. I would go along with you on that one. It's interesting that you should mention the Mayan calendar, which figures in your book. Because I was going to ask you, how important do you think that is to our understanding of the period immediately ahead of us?
Well, I guess if we truly want to understand it, I think it's an indispensable tool, as it seems to have captured the essence of time as having a purpose. And thanks to the work of Kalman in particular, we can look back at what we know of history through the lens of this calendar and see clearly how the predictive value of that calendar has played out. And as such, we can look with confidence to the, you know, scant amount of time left in the calendar until its completion. So I think it's an indispensable tool at coming to peace with the changes that are going on, because it prescribes, describes, and prescribes the purpose or plan of time. In the modern era, we have relegated time to kind of a flavorless, endless, random unfolding of events in a linear sequence, and with no real, you know, target or no real purpose. And this leaves one, you know, feeling kind of, I don't know, purposeless within ourselves. Like, what is the point if time is just going to go on forever and ever as it is now, seemingly disjointed, seemingly random? And I suppose the essence of the Mayan calendar, which is also the essence of one of the basic tenets of Buddhism, by the way, is that everything that has a beginning has an end. And although in the Western tradition we do, you know, give lip service to the beginning of time, we don't really think about the end of it necessarily. So the Mayans have gifted us with a very concrete, symbolic image of the plan and purpose of time, and it promises a wonderful outcome, a wondrous result, again, beyond anything that we have any historical precedence for, other than our liberation from the prison of time.
I mean, can you put people's minds at rest who have interpreted the Mayan calendar literally to indicate the end of the world?
Sure. Well, a large part of that, you know, disregarding the Hollywood hype and the media tendency to feed on fear-based images, one of the main reasons for that misinterpretation was actually the Aztec terminology for their version of the calendar. The Aztecs came along after the Mayans as far as predominance goes, and they took the Mayan calendar and took aspects of it. They didn't include all of it, but they took aspects of it, particularly this recognition of a 26,000-year solar cycle. And they took this 26,000-year cycle that records the movement of our entire solar system in space and divided it into five equal sections of time of about 5,200 years each. And in the Aztec way of measuring time, they called these worlds. So they did accurately predict that at this time there would be an end of a 5,200-year period called a world. And, of course, the Western mind took that to mean literally the end of the physical world. And they were only referring to a world of time. So more accurately, it's the end of a cycle. It's the end of an experience or dispensation of time. On the other side of that question, of course, is what quantum physics tells us, is that the world is arising in each split second and falling away, because it is a vibration. Everything in the universe is vibrating light or vibrating energy. So we can rest assured that we've been experiencing the end of the world in every nanosecond as it ends and reemerges in our very experience.
Right. That's interesting, an interesting statement you've made there, because it suggests that all of us are recreating the world from one split second to the next.
Indeed, indeed. That makes us pretty powerful beings, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yes. We don't realize how much power and responsibility we have. And it's sad that the majority of people probably do not consider for one moment that they have any hand in creating what is around them.
Well, that's the nature of being asleep, isn't it?
Mm. Absolutely, yes. Now, you talk about our fall from unity consciousness. Now, what do you attribute that to?
Well, I attribute it to our essential nature as free beings. In our freedom, we chose an option to experience separation or individuation. And in the source of our being, in the One, whatever you want to call that, the Creator, the Great Spirit, whatever appeals to you, in the freedom that we have in that creative source, all things are allowed. There's no judgment of or discrimination of that's a good thought and that's a bad thought. So as in our nature as a unified being living within that creative source, the idea had to inevitably emerge of what would it be like to step out of this experience of oneness. And, of course, that was immediately given permission, you might say. The divine creator basically said, oh, you want to check that out? Well, here's the Big Bang. Go and play. So, in a sense, the fall was an indication of the absolute confidence of our creator, of the divine, in our ability not only to imagine worlds and a universe of separate form and to experience all the learning that that involves, but that ultimately we come back. Ultimately we step out into our dream of separation, and ultimately we awaken and go back. The metaphysics of what I'm talking about now is based on a non-dual perspective on creation that what came to me through my exposure to A Course in Miracles.
Hmm. Yes, I'm mentioning that book. It's a wonderful book, which I have a copy of, but I must confess I've done little in the way of reading of recent times. I just don't seem to have had the time, but I know the bits I have read have been very, top drawer stuff. It really is excellent when you've reached that point where you're ready for it. I think you'd be aiming too high if you had only just started out on your spiritual path.
Mm-hmm.
I love another title of one of your chapters, Who's Your Daddy? Will all ETs please stand up? Makes me want to ask you, if everybody answered that question, would many people still be sitting down?
I don't think so, Mike, because we all are, we cannot limit our existence to this particular planet and this particular time phase. To do so would be to deny who we are, you know, as timeless spiritual beings. Ultimately, and to jump many steps forward in our expansion and understanding, we are the universe, and therefore all the life forms in the universe reflect an aspect of this one self. And interestingly, our DNA illustrates this principle that we really are all forms of life imagining all these separate experiences. So yes, we are ETs, and at the same time we're equally the insects and the rocks and the sky. This is a view of the ancients, you know, the Aboriginal cultures, and they looked at nature as a living integral part of a being of which they were also a part. So in our DNA we have the history, the record of the evolution of life going all the way back to the Big Bang. And so every form of life that is expressed in the universe is actually held in the cellular libraries of each one of us.
Hmm. Yes, I think the powers that be are of recent times beginning to come to the conclusion that what they call the junk DNA is in fact the same DNA that we have, it's the correct word, inherited from ETs.
Certainly, I wouldn't doubt that. And when you look at the genetic difference between, say, modern humans and chimpanzees, and the difference on the genetic level is only, less than 0.01% or something, it's no surprise that all of the possible expressions of the DNA could only involve slight alterations in the actual form of the DNA.
Right, yes. And I gather as our levels of consciousness increase, so in fact is our DNA, and it will lead us towards a higher status, if that's the right word, when we would eventually gain full consciousness.
Yeah.
Have you any thoughts about that?
Yeah, actually what you're saying taking me back to Barbara Marciniak's original work when she wrote Bringers of the Dawn back in the late 90s, I believe it was, or early 90s. And in that book, which was, I think, groundbreaking material channeled from the Palladians, she talked about our DNA like being a living library, but that all the books had been scattered, like a storm had gone through and wreaked havoc in the library. So all the books were scattered, which was a kind of a poetic way of describing or explaining how it is that we operate on, some say, as little as 4 to 6% of our DNA.
Right.
But that the frequencies of the light energy that are that's coming in now as we move into these alignments is actually reordering the library. She called them light filaments, and that the light filaments are going into the library now and putting all the books back in place, which to me is a beautiful analogy of the potential for the activation, if some, if not all, of this dormant DNA and the full expression, or at least another major phase or stage of expression of the human template, much as a butterfly emerges from a cocoon. We're basically talking about the same unit of life, and yet it's expressing through completely different genetic informational fields.
Right. Now, you've mentioned the Palladians there, and I recall in an earlier chapter of your book, you refer to the great central sun of the Pleiades, mm-hmm. but I can't for the life of me think why, but perhaps you might like to mention it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Alcyone. And the interesting thing about the Pleiades, now Barbara Clough, who wrote the foreword to my book, and also subscribes to many of these ideas about the Mayan calendar and supports Kalaman's work as well, talks about this 26,000-year cycle of our solar system. Now, many people ascribe this 26,000-year cycle to an apparent wobble of the axis of the Earth. But Walter Crittenden, in his book, The Lost Star, says a simpler explanation would be that our solar system is simply rotating out in space in a gravitational relationship with another body in space. And Barbara Clough provides actually an explanation, an illustration of this, in showing how there is a spiral system of stars rotating in an ever-expanding circle as you move away from the Pleiades, with Alcyone as the gravitational center of this system of stars, of which ours is one. So, in other words, relative to us in our 26,000-year cycle, Alcyone is a stable point, and this would be gravitational as well. What's more interesting to me, though, is the fact that this cycle, as it relates to us, puts us in the alignment with the galactic center only for two brief periods of time, cosmologically speaking at least, and for the most part in our cycle, we are out in what is referred to as the galactic night. In other words, we're not in this direct alignment with the galactic center. However, even when we are cycling outside of this galactic influence, because the Pleiades is relatively stable, it is in the galactic photon band all the time, like a permanent fixture. So it provides us on the Earth, when we're outside of that influence, a link, you might say, or a connection to that galactic level of consciousness, or the divine feminine, if you prefer. This is perhaps one reason why all ancient cultures, to one degree or another, recognized the centrality of our relationship with the Pleiades. And I find it really interesting that the Subaru car company, Subaru, is actually Japanese for Pleiades.
And is it really?
Yes, and if you look at the little decal or the little symbol on the hood of each Subaru, there's a little star map of the Pleiades, with one star in particular very large. So next time you see a Subaru, check out the little logo, and you'll see Alcyone, the central sun, and the Pleiades represented.
I will definitely do that. That is something of interest. Now, you talk of the collapse of time and refer to the Earth changes leading to a golden age. What is the golden age?
Well, the golden age would be, the term actually comes from the Vedic or Hindu tradition, which also recognizes this cycle, this 26,000-year cycle. And in that particular worldview or cosmic view, they say that half the time of the cycle we're actually moving away from the galactic influence, and the effect on consciousness is that we go into deeper states of darkness or deception, into the depths of materialism. Now, although in the modern ego we like to think of the material age as being the pinnacle of human achievement, from the spiritual perspective, it really is, we've lost our connection with spirituality by our obsession with materialism. However, as we cycle around and we begin to move toward the galactic center, and there's almost a cosmic Doppler effect here. As we move away from the galactic light, it actually lowers in frequency, much as the siren lowers in pitch as the ambulance leaves you. But as you move towards the source, as you move towards the galactic center, the frequency actually goes up and is accelerated. And according to this cyclic view, we will ultimately, in moving back towards the source of energy in the galactic center, experience periods of rising consciousness. Well, we will remember ourselves as spiritual beings having a human experience. And this ultimately culminates in societies and institutions that will reflect this higher level of awareness.
So that is evidently what you refer to in the book as galactic citizenship.
Yes.
So at that stage, logically, again, we would have a level of galactic consciousness.
Yes.
Something I guess we can't really imagine now, because it will be far removed from the level of consciousness we have at the moment.
Well, it's already showing up in the multiple experiences around the world with extraterrestrials and the crop circles and other phenomena that really can't be explained in earthly terms. So I do feel that we're teetering on the edge of what many call disclosure, or the public acknowledgement of our relationship with our galactic neighbors, that is, extra-dimensional and extraterrestrial civilizations. So the physicists and the cosmologists and those who look logically at the statistics, you know, the probability of life similar to ours in the universe, has always been, you know, for the last decade, has acknowledged the probability of there being intelligent life, both up to our stage of development and beyond. It's just a mathematical, inevitable probability that this exists. And yet our awareness of ourselves on this planet has not allowed our full participation or awareness into that. You could say that the galactic community is like a country club, and we're the bumpkins down the block. You know, we haven't really learned how to take care of our own business. We're still squabbling amongst ourselves and dirtying the nest, as it were, with our neglect of the planet and overuse of resources, etc. And it's almost like the country club is saying, you know, we really want to invite these folks into the club, but we can't until they begin to, you know, exhibit better behavior. And yet, ultimately, we may just have to accept them as they are. So I think we're on the verge of that. You know, if you talk to some of the other folks in this field, particularly David Wilcock and Stephen Greer, you know, they are very focused on assisting and creating the awareness of this inevitable disclosure.
Yes, absolutely. Now, we ought to come to, I guess, what you would consider to be a more important part of your book, that is giving people practical things that they can do now on their way to this new period of time. Now, you mentioned about envisioning the world you want. Add a few comments to that, please.
Sure. Well, again, we touched on earlier this emerging idea of how powerful we are and how we truly do create our realities, not just partially, but completely. And again, quantum physics has given us an understanding and a language whereby we can actually accept this. So the collapse of time really has to do in part with our understanding that it's the quality of my thoughts and feelings in the moment that are creating my map or road of my future experiences. And so the present moment offers me the perfect opportunity to create the world I want, to create the world I desire. I guess one of the hurdles to overcome in this understanding is the acceptance that the world I am experiencing is the result of my thoughts, my intentions, and my desires up until this time. And if my world that I'm experiencing now is less than perfect, it's going to take a certain humility to accept that I created this circumstance, that I chose this experience. Horrendous as it may be, and how improbable that I would consciously choose a negative experience, yet on some level I must accept that I did. If I can take total responsibility for my experience in this moment as only and ever being self-created, I am liberating my creativity to now create the next moment according to what I truly desire. It's also helpful for us to lay aside our tendency to judge behavior, especially our own behavior, and accept again the non-dual proposal that all behavior comes from love. And bear with me now, because I know in the world it doesn't look like that. But an expression of love is very clearly, and it's very easy to accept an expression of love as coming from love. But what about what we call bad behavior? If you look at what we call bad behavior as simply a call for love, it's an acknowledgement. When someone's in bad behavior, they're actually saying, I'm not experiencing love in this moment, and this is the best way that I can demonstrate how I feel. I'm feeling lost, I'm feeling hurt, I'm feeling abandoned, I'm feeling helpless or whatever, and I act out. Much like a child, you know, most loving, compassionate parents do not punish a child for crying, although crying may be an unpleasant experience. It's recognized as a call for love. So we need to be that compassionate and that understanding with ourselves, that all my behaviors in the past have been a call for love. And if I can extend that to those around me, I can begin to recognize that love truly is all there is. Love truly is the power behind creation, even though it's showing up in forms of what I judge as opposites. And this experience of opposites, you know, good and bad and war and peace and life and death, this is not the condition of the mind in its healed state. It's only the condition of a mind that is inwardly split or divided between truth, reality, and unreality or illusion. So once I grasp these ideas and take responsibility for what I'm experiencing in the moment, I begin to appreciate, it begins to dawn on me that the future is wide open. It's a sea of all possibilities. It's just neutral energy. And however I apply my mind, my desires, and my intentions, I'm actually creating, again, that next split second that's emerging in the quantum vibration. So I truly am already creating my experience. I'm just now beginning to become conscious of that. And this, of course, is another way of explaining how the Mayans, going back to the calendar, describe this time of the end of the calendar. They say that the predicted outcome of time is that we will know ourselves as conscious co-creators of realities. It doesn't say that we will become, because we're already doing that, but that we will know what we've already been doing now for eons and eons, and that is creating our reality.
Right. So as a civilization, do you feel that we have a great future where the grand harmonic plan is concerned?
Unimaginably great, and beyond anything we've experienced before. Take the best you can think of the human drama, and multiply that by a million, and you still won't be able to imagine where we're headed and what we're doing. Mm. You know, this we pride ourselves in thinking we're modern and we're the crown of creation and the epitome of evolution, and yet on a grander scale, we are not yet even fully formed as beings, individual or unified for that matter. As a matter of fact, as the species, the human race is still in a larval stage. We're still blindly wriggling around, bumping into each other, thinking we're separate beings. So we have so much more potential than we have past, than we have history. And it's our past and our history that is keeping us locked in these patterns of separation, of war, domination, fear, territoriality, etc. So the end of time is simply the end of the need for past reference as we move together to begin to co-create a world that we truly desire, one based on equality and freedom and respect and an acknowledgement of our divine union.
Right. Now, Dave, we're rapidly getting near to the end of the program, and I want to give you sufficient time to take a few minutes to tell people about your website, your e-books, or anything else that you would like to direct them to.
Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. My wife, Irina, and I have a website. It's at www.bluesunenergetics.net, Blue Sun Energetics. We named the site actually after the Hopi prophecy around this time of the shift. They said that post-2012, we will live in a solar system where instead of one sun, there will be two in the sky, and the second will be blue. My interpretation of that is that it's probably already there in another vibratory range or dimension. That's what is changing is us. So as we pop up to the next octave, you might say, of awareness into other full-dimensional awareness towards that, we're going to perceive a lot more in the sky, and this blue sun apparently is one of the things. So on the website, if people go there, they'll see that we have a number of programs. Our main focus these last few years has been teaching classes. We do classes primarily in two topic areas. One is a licensing program for spiritual healers. So we have a licensing program where people in alternative healing, for example, who want the protection and the benefit of a professional license can take our course, and with other things they need to do, they can become qualified as a licensed spiritual health coach. And we also have a three-day program leading to a certification as a spiritual dowser. Now, I know in the UK, spiritual healing and spiritual dowsing are much more, you know, accepted, and I don't know if they're quite yet mainstream, but I do notice there's a lot of websites from the UK recognizing the value and the benefits of spiritual healing and spiritual dowsing, whereas in the United States, this is still kind of new. So for many people, you know, this is cutting edge, and also their introduction, you might say, into metaphysics and spirituality is through these healing programs. I do want also to mention that our publisher, Red Wheel Wiser, has just in the last week contracted with us to publish the next work, which will be a compilation of Irina and my dowsing manual. So we've written a total of three manuals for the dowsing course, which by this time next year will actually be again published and put out there as kind of a self-study empowerment program to put a lot of these ideas that we talk about in Navigating the Collapse of Time into practice. So on the website, you'll also see a number of energetic products that we endorse, and other goodies, some free articles. So definitely invite folks. We're starting a new online program for our courses. So definitely I would invite listeners to have a visit, and if you like, sign up for our newsletter. We don't bombard you with newsletters, probably just once every quarter or so, to keep you abreast of our activities and travels. And enjoy yourself on the site, and please get in touch and let us know that you were on the call today, and we always appreciate comments and feedback as well on the website. You can contact me personally at info@bluesunenergetics.net, and also the book itself, as I mentioned, is now on Amazon.com as well as BarnesandNoble.com. And I should also mention it's also available as a 6-hour audio book. So if you prefer to listen than to read, if you go to the Amazon site, you'll also see it as an audio download.
That's brilliant, yes.
That's it.
Right, that's fine. It's been very, very interesting talking to you, Dave, and I think it's been very informative, and I'm sure our listeners are very pleased they tuned in to you. As your book has now been released, I hope it gives you the success I feel it should do. It's an excellent book and full of very, I think, sort of high teachings that must help people through this period. So I would thank you, Dave, very much for appearing on the program. It's been very nice to have you here. And maybe over the months when you get this compilation ready, but perhaps we ought to have you back and have a chat about that.
Oh, I would look forward to that, Mike, and thank you very much. I appreciate the questions you asked and your openness to the ideas in the book.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Right, friends, I've got a minute or two here just to quickly inform you of next week's guest, who is Michelle Eloff. She's quite a well-known trance channeler, and she has various masters that come through her, and I must say I rate her quality and the level of spiritual information very highly, and I'm sure she's well-known to many of the listeners already, so that's certainly, to my mind, one guest to look forward to. So I would thank you very much for being with me today, and I know you must also have enjoyed Dave's talk there. It was excellent. So God bless you all, and I hope you'll be with me next week. Thank you.